Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode number 348 of Film Wax Radio. My name is Adam Shartoff. I'm your host. I interview people from the independent film community. Today is absolutely no exception. We are in Montpelier, Vermont. We're visiting one of the podcast sponsors. We were invited up to the Vermont College of Fine Arts, and we find ourselves among the faculty and students who are part of the MFA film program, week-long residency here in Montpelier. I was invited up here. I took my son, who was on vacation this week, and we came up here and we were treated like, you know, really, really well. I have to say thank you to everybody here. And as a bonus thing, I was able to, you know, interview some of the faculty who are filmmakers. And among them is the chair of the MFA program, Laura Colello, who some time ago made a number of features, actually, but her most recent feature, which I saw, was called Breakfast with Curtis. I got to meet her some time ago, but it was very brief, and this was finally our time to sit together and get to know each other a little bit more. And so my conversation with Laura Colello, who teaches screenwriting at Brown University and as also runs this program, is will be the first up here in the first segment. So we'll be talking to Laura. And then after that, we'll be talking to two other filmmakers who are participating as faculty here. One is Jake Mahaffey, who has a film called Free Indeed, which has been making the festival circuit. I believe it had its world premiere in Vienna and then went to South by Southwest and then most recently at Nashville. Well, we'll talk about all that, but it's a wonderful narrative film called Free Indeed, and it was shot in Memphis. I'm hoping to catch it this Saturday at the Independent Film Festival of Boston, though it will also be coming up the following weekend, May 6th, 7th, 8th, that weekend, at the Montclair Film Festival. So if you're in the Northeast, you'll have several opportunities to see it. Try to see it in either one of those festivals. As I speak, we're still in Montpelier. We're heading out momentarily. But I did get a chance this morning to speak with Malik Vital, who is another filmmaker here in the faculty, and he made a film called Imperial Dreams, which stars John Boyega, who many people, of course, know from Star Wars: The Force Awakens, and is an enormous star now. But anyway, this is a beautiful film, very different from the other works you may have seen Boyega in. Anyway, we'll be talking to Malik in our last segment, and his film will be coming out in the fall, I believe. It had its premiere at Sundance. They decided to postpone the premiere since Star Wars came out. Look, you know, smart move, right? Anyway, it's been a spectacular time at the Vermont College of Fine Arts. We'll get to a little bit more about that at the end of the show. But first, let's go to my conversation with Laura Colello, as we talk about her film work as well as her teaching and about her role here at the Vermont College of Fine Arts. Yeah, you sound good.
Okay.
You have a good voice for
podcast.
Hold it a little closer, too.
A little closer?
Yeah, that's even better.
That's better?
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you remember that we met?
I'm sorry?
Do you remember we met once?
No.
It was so brief, and you were really in the middle of something. So, but I have a better memory of it because remember you showed Breakfast with Curtis at the Core Club? Schiller did your Q&A?
Yeah,
I was there.
Oh, cool.
During the screening, Mark and I went up to, they have a dining room up there.
Uh-huh.
And we did a podcast together.
Oh, great. Oh, so you didn't go to the screening.
That's lame. I'd seen it.
<I'm>
Yeah, sort of lame.
So you'd seen it. Well, that's good.
I'm going to be lame either way. It's just a matter of what the level of lameness is going to be, you know? No, and we were introduced very, you know, again, you were dealing with your screening and an audience, so. You know, I don't expect. Yeah. And it was a while ago already, right? Like 3 years ago.
Let's see, 2000, that might have been 2013 or 14, yeah.
Yeah, somewhere in there, somewhere right? In there. I can even move over here.
Yeah.
You have to crane your neck.
Oh, okay. Sure. Okay.
Yeah, so anyway. But no, I had seen that because I think, I guess Mark must have shared that with me or something. Somebody at his office, uh-huh. That's my guess. And then he did one more time. I had him on. And then within like days, he had that accident, that terrible accident. So take me back a little bit. What was your entryway into filmmaking?
I studied film as an undergrad at Harvard, and that was 20...
It doesn't matter.
20-ish
I'm not putting
years
you on the
ago. Spot. And, well, it was a 16-millimeter-based program, so I did a lot of 16-millimeter kind of shooting and editing and uh-huh. on Steenbecks, and uh-huh. I had amazing faculty there. My hero, Raul Ruiz, was the sort of senior advisor when I was there, and Miklos Jancsó, who's a Hungarian filmmaker, and mm-hmm. Rob Moss, who's a great documentary filmmaker. So mm-hmm. really fabulous faculty. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of worked as a camera assistant for a while after college and mm-hmm. made a short. And they made three features, and it feels like mm-hmm. that was all fabulous.
Were they all narratives? Or?
Yeah, all narratives, yeah.
Yeah? I know you're in Los Angeles.
No, I'm not.
Oh, you're not?
Providence, Rhode Island.
That's right. Breakfast with Curtis was shot in Providence for
Yeah, that was
Rhode
in
Island, right? Yep. Some reason I had some in my head that. Are you still in Rhode Island?
Yeah.
Oh, you are.
Yeah, I teach there. And
Are you at Brown? Or?
Yeah.
Okay, very good. Well, you made Breakfast Occurs there. Is there any kind of filmmaking community up there? I know you're working there, so that's.
You know, I have a few friends who work in film there, but it's. Yeah. I wouldn't say there's a really active filmmaking community. Mm-hmm. Films come in and out. There's tons of student mm-hmm. filmmakers, mm-hmm. you know, through RISD, where I used to teach. And
oh, right.
Brown,
yeah.
And, you know, other schools, too, that mm-hmm. are there because it's a big kind of college town. But, yeah, I wouldn't say there that I have a ton of friends there who are filmmakers. You know, I have a handful.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're at the Vermont College of Fine Arts, and you are the chair of the yeah. of this film
founding,
MFA?
Yeah, founding faculty chair.
Yeah. 3 years now?
Yeah, we started in October 2013, uh-huh. and that was our first residency.
How did that come about?
Well, they found me and kind of approached me, uh-huh. and I came up and interviewed for it a couple of times. Other people, I guess, they reached out to came up also to interview, mm-hmm. and I got the gig. And it's, let's see, I don't know how long, I guess we worked from January until October of 2013, kind of mm-hmm. setting the program up, and I hired all the faculty and
you did?
Guests. And yeah.
yeah. How did you do that? I know Josephine Decker, who's been on this show
yeah.
a couple of times and is a friend. Yeah. Terrence Nance has been on a couple of times. I mean, Nina Davenport, we were just talking with, she's been here for a while, right? And a few other people I know, like Till Schauder. Mm-hmm. How did you find this great group of people?
I really wanted this program to feature active working filmmakers who are
yeah.
doing stuff now and uh-huh. kind of forward thinking and
right.
And whose work I really responded to. And I, you know, met some of the people in festivals like mm-hmm. Terrence and Till
mm-hmm.
and
oh, okay.
on the festival circuit. Jake Mahaffey, who's here now, I've known for a long time. He went to RISD when I started teaching there. And we've just been friends over the years. He's made some amazing films. Mm-hmm. And Malik, I met through Josephine and Terrence.
Right.
And Nina and I go back to college. We've known each other since college. And Dan Schrecker was on the founding faculty, too. He's a kind of visual effects and animation specialist who works a lot with Darren Aronofsky and Wes Anderson and different people, Coen Brothers recently.
Mm-hmm. Are they filmmakers? I'm just kidding. I'm kidding.
So he's been, uh-huh. You know, he's been sort of on. And we have kind of some rotating faculty who can't come all the time because they're working or have, you know, films that come up. And so all of us kind of, I had a residency in Italy, last residency, so I missed half of it. Lisa Lehman is another great person I want to
yes.
mention who's on the faculty. She's a doc filmmaker from L.A.
Yeah,
she's
I just saw her, a bit of her lecture or workshop or what
yeah.
have you. Yeah.
And Maria Cohn, who's
mm-hmm.
also
right.
a new faculty, who's been great. She Kochi. Let's see, who else? I don't want to miss anyone now.
Now you can't.
Yeah, I know. I think that's everybody who's here right now. Yeah.
Yeah, it seems like what's exciting about being in the original, what have you, is the feeling of all the possibilities. You can grow this program in just about any direction. But I like what you're saying about forward-thinking, progressive types of filmmakers. And I don't mean that just politically. I mean that artistically in other ways. You know, people that are making films that matter in the moment.
And also a lot of our faculty are very hands-on and play sort of multiple roles in their projects. Writer, directors, some of us shoot, a lot of us edit, produce. So that's great for students, too, to kind of have faculty who know all of those different kind of aspects of the making process and even into distribution and all that stuff.
Yeah. Oh, does that come up a lot, those types of conversations? You know, getting the film into the world, the commerce side of, is that a big part of the program? Or
it's not a big part of the program because right now they're so focused on, it's a really project-based program.
Yeah.
So a lot of, because it's only a two-year program, most of them are working on shorts or feature scripts. Of course, if you're working on something feature-length, you start to talk more about commerce, not so much with short projects. It's more really focused on, this isn't really, we're really focused on developing the individual vision of the filmmakers and the kind of developing work. And
People work on their own at home or wherever they're going to do their project, and then they come back here for this last week of the program, right, for the residency.
It's actually the first week of every semester. Starts with a one-week residency.
Okay, it starts with it. So everybody comes in for the first week. I thought they also came back to show the work.
Well, do at the end. So as a student, over the 2 years, you come to 5 residencies. So
I see.
One, they bookend.
They're 2 every year, or semester?
Because we have a year-round program. We don't break for the summer or something like that. October and April are when the residencies are, and then the 6 months that follow the semesters.
Gotcha. So what kind of, when you were growing up in Rhode Island?
I grew up in Providence,
In Providence.
Yeah.
Did you have from the beginning, did you always have a fondness for films, or is that something that kind of...
I always was fond of theater, I worked at a local repertory theater, Trinity Rep, when I was a kid. And
do you know, I apologize for interrupting. I used to live in Boston many years ago, and went to see a production with my friend. We were, both in Boston, and we got tickets to see a play at the Trinity Rep.
Yeah. What'd you see?
Master Harold and the Boys.
Oh, yeah. I remember when that was.
I
do, too. Yeah.
You had to be a toddler.
Well, I would always see posters and things like that, but I don't think I was
a
toddler.
It was amazing. Yeah. An amazing production. Well, it was in the 80s. The one I saw.
Yeah, I was around that because I was in productions when I was small, when I was a child, and then.
For those listening, she's very, very youthful. So I have no idea. I'm not going to hazard a guess. Although, with the running a program like this, you also have to have a lot of experience. one would imagine, but it was a remarkable production. It was a great play. I always had a fondness for
Ed Hall.
F.L. Fugard. Hmm?
Oh, Ed Hall was in it. I just remember that. Like, I
don't know
I
who that is,
saw
but
it. Yeah,
did you?
Was,
man,
an actor, yeah.
I'm trying to remember. I subsequently saw a number of plays on Broadway, or actually one was at Yale with Fugard, even in it.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's cool.
One was with the Blood Knot. Is that what it's called?
Blood Ties?
Blood Ties?
I'm not
Blood
sure.
Knot, it was
Blood
called.
Knot?
It's not as
well-known
play, but it's an Athel Fugard play.
I don't know that
or,
one.
It was Athel. I think it's Athel Fugard. But anyway, there was a South African actor. And they were both. One was actually black, and Athel Fugard, of course, is, I think, at least part white. I don't know. But anyway, they were played brothers.
And that was on Broadway?
Yes, that one was on Broadway. Back then, and this was probably maybe the early 90s, he was in a major internationally known playwright. Huge, but it all began with Master Harold. Anyway, I got a little off track, but I liked it. Tangents are always good. Yeah. So your original love of theater ended up going into film.
It wasn't until college that I started even that film was even on my radar.
Yeah.
And I just kind of went
Right.
Forgot well, living about theater.
In, right. Well, living in that part of the country, as well as maybe I'm thinking back then, there weren't too many film programs anyway.
Yeah.
They were incorporated into semiotics classes or other departments.
Yeah. It wasn't like now. I mean, like no one in high school, when I was in high school, said, I'm going to be a filmmaker. Not in my high school. You know what I mean? Like, nobody was thinking about that.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but.
Not many people in the country were.
Yeah.
You know, and those who were probably like living in L.A. or, you know, that's what they thought about when they becoming a filmmaker. They're talking about making, you know, like studio filmmaker. That's kind of, there wasn't a whole, I mean, you couldn't go to Montpelier, Vermont and think you're going to go to some film program.
Right, film school.
Just shows how much things have changed, you know.
Although in high school, I was in what was, I think, like a proto indie film called A Complex World, or It's a Complex World. And it was like,
after all.
No, I know. It was just a complex, I think a complex world, by a filmmaker from Rhode Island. And it was, it actually kind of ages pretty well. Like it's, you can see it somewhere, but it's like, it was this crazy story about, it was based in a nightclub there and a kind of like bomb that was planted in the basement. And then all these different characters, like terrorists coming in and out and bands coming in and out and a lot of drugs and sex. And it was a funny movie. And I played like a, you know, underage girl in the club or something who was getting picked up by someone. But it was fun. It's a good movie.
What was it called?
It's a Complex World.
It's a Complex World. Yes, you did say. So you went to Brown. But it was, I assume afterwards when you made your first film, it was probably... Your feature wasn't like
to Harvard,
I'm sorry, Harvard. That's right. You
and
did say
then
that.
After that,
you just made shorts.
Yeah,
maybe.
I made shorts there.
Okay.
Yeah. And then another short after I graduated that was called Statuary, which is like a 25-minute black and white arty narrative. And then a few years later, I made my first feature, which was called Tax Day.
Was that also shot in the?
Yeah.
All shot in Rhode Island. Yeah. You are a. Tried and true Rhode Islander, at least
New
Englander.
My second feature was shot in Providence and Paris, and then I had footage that I'd actually collected from all over the world, so that one was kind of...
Well, you know what they say about Paris. It's the Providence of France.
Exactly.
It's a good place to shoot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Always write in a scene in Paris. That's my advice.
So was teaching like a necessary byproduct, or was that always something that you sort of had a hankering or knew you were going to do, or...
to it pretty early at RISD, and you know, I love working in film, so teaching 16 millimeter is always a blast, and I miss it, but unfortunately it's kind of they're still doing it there, but I kind of moved over to Brown, and now I'm teaching screenwriting mainly. I did a little bit of 16 millimeter and video production in a couple of courses there, but mostly it's screenwriting now, because there's just a huge demand for it and they can't get enough courses to like fulfill the demand for screenwriting. Yeah, it's really popular.
Do you show your films in those cases, or
sometimes?
By the way, I was actually contacted by Kodak recently. I think there is there was this long period of between the death of vinyl, to make this ongoing analogy, but you know, till the return of vinyl. Of course, it's, you know, obviously, it's always been something used by DJs and that kind of thing, and collectors and all. But it's made sort of a resurgence. And, you know, I don't think film quite even had time to go away or die. Like, there's been such a stronghold. And maybe that's because there's some of these major Hollywood popular filmmakers who have been champions of shooting on film and wanting to project on film as well. But it seems like already there seems to be something bubbling with the...
Like
really?
A resurgence of 16 millimeters specifically, or like all kinds
of
film?
I think maybe all sorts.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see how 35 can, I mean, just like...
It seems impossible, or, well,
just
difficult.
You know, expensive to shoot in 35 with all the gear that requires. And I mean, I don't know.
It always requires a crew. There's no way around it.
Yeah, whereas 16, I can see how that's still maybe viable.
Right.
You know, given that... I don't know if you can't project in many places in 35 millimeter anymore, tragically.
Yeah, I know. I was there, but there is also like in New York, the Metrograph Theater. Have you heard about it?
Oh, yeah.
It opened up in the Lower East Side.
Yeah, I heard about
and,
that.
And, you know, they're equipped for projecting film. I'm not sure what's I just saw something too. I should know the answer to this. But anyway, it was there are still several theaters in New York that are able to do it, you know. And there was this one film I had the filmmaker on, and he's only showing his film where they can be projected.
Mm-hmm.
So his name is Dennis Houck. He's an LA-based filmmaker, mm-hmm. and he had this. It's a bit of a gumshoe mystery. It's mm-hmm. really it was pretty good. It was called Too Late.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I did a Q&A with him at opening on his premiere night. But the night before, I saw it at the Metrograph, I guess that was the premiere or a Buzz film screening, rather, where they also showed it projected. Mm-hmm. And it was just like, wow, it feels so great to see this again. I don't know how much of that is nostalgic, mm-hmm. you know, and would somebody half my age have that relationship to it, that experience, that aesthetic, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, what's your experience as a teacher? Although you seem like you're doing mostly, as you said, screenwriting, so I don't know.
I mean, my experience with 16mm was always that students love working with it.
Yeah.
They just love handling the cameras and seeing the film when it comes back from the lab. And, you know, now I don't get to project in 16mm anymore. Mm-hmm. When I've done it at Brown, it's like transferred to, you know, a digital format. But so that's, you know, that's already losing something, and cutting in video is losing some of the, you know, some of the magic, some of the stuff that was fun about it, mm. you know, for me.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's the shooting part is still fun. I think shooting in 16mm with a Bolix or I love the Bolix and I love Super 8.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think you're right. I think those formats are still, you know, there's still a demand actually.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
For that. You have plans to make another film, by the way?
I'm finishing a short right now.
Okay.
And it's called The Flying Electric. And I'm working on a feature project, a feature script.
Oh, very good. Okay. So hopefully in 2017-18, we'll see a new feature by Laura Colello.
Okay.
And for those interested, check out Vermont College. I mean, they've been a sponsor. So this has been a pleasure. But it's in no way an infomercial, by the way, so just get that out of your head. This is me wanting to talk to people that are also filmmaking and, you know,
yeah.
up here in Vermont. But you can check out the program at vcfa.edu/film.
All right. Thank you.
I know
you.
This by heart. Well, thank you for doing this.
Sure.
Appreciate it.
Oh.
It's nice to see you.
It's great to have you with us. Thanks.
Thank you. Jake Mahaffey has this film. It's called Free Indeed. It's produced by our friend Mike Ryan. And it was shot in Memphis, Tennessee. And the film is brand new. You haven't seen it yet. Maybe some of you have, because it has played at, I think he mentioned it was in Vienna. And then it played in a couple of festivals like South by Southwest. And just was at Nashville. So now it's going to be at the Independent Film Festival of Boston. Saturday. I'm recording this on a Thursday. I'm hopefully putting this up overnight. So if you're in the Boston area, you're checking out this festival, or you're curious after listening to the conversation with Jake, you have an opportunity to see this movie Free Indeed, which we'll discuss on this segment coming up right now. And it'll be playing Saturday night in Somerville at the Independent Film Festival of Boston. Again, this filmmaker's name is Jake Mahaffey. Thank God. That would have been tragic. You're tragic. Just don't slurp into the... It's a slurp-free pot. There you go. That came through loud and clear. No, help yourself. All right. Yeah, don't let it get colder, for God's sake. Okay, very good. So Jake Mahaffey, who is a New Zealand native, right?
No, native. I grew up in Ohio. I just moved there 3 years ago.
Okay, so yeah, because I hear more Cincinnati than Auckland. Is that a place in New Zealand, Auckland?
Yeah,
that's hold that closer to.
Yeah,
sorry,
that's where
thank
I'm living
you.
Now.
Is it?
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah.
So there is some Auckland in this, and we're in Ohio.
Just middle of state, all over.
A little drop. Yeah.
Closer, make that right up on it.
Yeah, they're not dynamic, Mike. So I find that it sounds really. That's great.
Is it good?
Okay. Yeah, it's perfect. Yeah, yeah.
Right.
You don't have to fillet it quite, but that's next. Okay, yeah, I didn't hear a New Zealand accent, but I thought maybe I just hadn't heard you speaking enough to.
No, we just immigrated there 3.5 years ago. So I'm from Ohio originally and lived out lived here in New England for a while.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
So
went to RISD as an undergrad, and then I taught at a small school for 6 years near Providence.
Oh, okay. Is that how you knew Laura? Is that how she recruited you? Because you seem to also have a lot of Rhode Island in your story.
Yeah. No, so I was a student at RISD. She taught there.
Okay.
I first met her there, and then we ran into each other in festivals over the years, and then we ended up living on the two ends of the same street together by chance in Providence.
Oh, okay. Very good. Yeah. And so what was the impetus for moving to New Zealand?
It's a lot of reasons.
Okay.
Mainly just to be as isolated as possible.
Is that right?
Yeah.
How's that working out?
Good, great.
It is?
Yeah.
The adapting was not as difficult because that was something, the goals were just so strong. And
no, because of globalization, New Zealand's like another state of the United States at this point. So,
really?
It's not that.
That's
different.
A little disappointing then.
Yeah.
Because you're looking for even more.
Well, no. I mean, it's still geographically isolated. So,
yeah.
But asking the question as far as how difficult it was, or the adaptation, it was pretty straightforward. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Are you able to work out there?
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's great. I mean, I just with stability and, and some funding occasionally from the New Zealand Film Commission, because I'm a permanent resident there, so I'm able to get more done than I was here in the States.
Mm-hmm. Did you marry into New England?
No, I've been with my wife for a while, and we just immigrated there. I got a teaching job.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Very good.
So I'm an associate professor there at the University of Auckland.
Okay.
They have a small screen production program.
Uh-huh. Okay. So your film, we're here, I don't know if we can necessarily discuss this aspect that it's screening in this residency program, but it's, I mean, we don't have to really dwell on that. We can talk about the fact that it's doing all these festivals, this narrative feature of yours called Free Indeed. Mm. How many films have you made up to date?
Feature length? I mean, that was my third feature length film.
Where are the other two?
War is one and Wellness is another.
Okay.
So War was I shot it over 5 years on 16mm hand crank movie camera. And that premiered at Sundance in 2004. And Wellness was a DV film about a pyramid scheme salesman trying to succeed at a business that doesn't exist. And that came out in 2008 and got grand jury prize at South by Southwest.
Great.
So those are all low budget, no budget, no crew, where I would operate, direct everything myself. And then this Free Indeed is the first film where there was a small crew and producer and budget.
And did you shoot digitally?
On Alexa,
you shot digitally though.
Yeah.
Right. So wait, the one that you hand cranked then you had a sync, a sound, I assume.
Mm-hmm.
Or there was no sound. I don't know which. But
So we shot it like a silent film.
Yeah. Right.
And then I went back and composed something like a radio play, and it would weave in and out of sync. So I did a lot of Foley, learned a lot about sound design that way.
You know, as you were describing just that whole approach, I'm thinking Guy Madden. Mm. And people like that who are making films that kind of intentionally self-referential on some level as a film, like I'm making a film now. Like Once Upon a Time, obviously, in order to, as you said, in the silent film era, there was no choice. I mean, and to a great extent, for those shooting video or whatever, you know, it was until maybe the 60s till they had sound sync and all this as an option. And now if you make a film intentionally, though, doing that, you are creating another level to engaging the audience now.
I suppose I'd done my undergraduate thesis film as a hand crank film, and I had no idea that it was in any way referring to silent movies or anything. There was nothing nothing like that. It was just the camera that was accessible to me, I guess.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. No, it was really naive in a way that I just simply didn't care what was normal. Uh-huh. Or what would be perceived as normal, so I just shot at hand crank because I wanted to. And
yeah, was it an aesthetic or just a necessity? Is it?
Well, for the war feature, it was just a necessity.
Yeah,
and I tried to use it. I mean, it was basically just trying to attenuate time and alter sort of performance through the speed and the start and stop of the camera. But you know, the Bolex, the camera that I had at that point, only has a 30-second spring wind. So the longest shot I could get with 30 seconds, but if I hand cranked it, I could go for 3 minutes.
Gotcha.
So I wanted long shots, and so it came out of that.
What is Free Indeed about?
It's about a man who tries to perform a miracle and fails, and it's based on a true story. It's set in a storefront church, and a woman brings a boy who is ill for healing to the church, and a man who tries to help.
And where did you shoot that?
We shot at Memphis, Tennessee in February 2014.
Okay.
And we had two actors, David Harewood and Edwina Finley, who came in, and everyone else was local.
Uh-huh. And you wrote that, or?
Yeah, I wrote that screenplay. I wrote the first draft, God, in like 05, 06. Went through like 23, 27, God, I don't even know, like around 30 drafts of it. And it took 10 years. So, you know, what's that, 05 to 2014?
Yeah.
Wait, what did I just say? It showed in, oh, we shot in 2014. Right, sorry. And then it premiered in 2015 at Venice.
Okay. So, but the gestation period
was
like
10 years of just developing. Yeah. And, you know, I went through different producers, different people were on board to try and get it made, and there was just nothing happening. And I was a total neophyte at that point with working with other people, and finally when Mike Ryan came on board, he really got it moving.
Oh, Mike Ryan.
Produced you? Mike S. Ryan?
Yeah, very well.
Oh, great. How do you know him?
Well, first of all, he's been on the podcast, and I you should go listen to that episode.
Oh, well.
Because he's really a visionary. I mean, he really has a really different concept of what he'll say everything that he thinks. You know? I mean, that's another thing that's real. That's kind of, you know what I mean? Like, are you relating here?
Yeah.
And
that's what's great about having a producer, because you don't. Yeah. It's not about agreeing necessarily, but just that he's straightforward.
No, I don't necessarily mean you agree with what he's saying all the time, but just that you agree with my description.
Oh, no, absolutely.
Yeah, you know, he speaks his mind. But you'll see him, like, you know, you'll go to South by Southwest and you'll see him there just like, I don't know, looking like, emailing somebody. He's just sitting in, like, you know, an Alamo draft house. But you see, you know, and then he's just totally seems to be against what South by is kind of become or, you know, becoming.
Were you there this year?
I was. Okay. I did an event, actually,
yeah,
this year.
There.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So yeah, I kept seeing Free Indeed. I around in my purview, but I horribly. It's very frustrating.
There's a lot of stuff going on. So.
It's true, but certain films make their presence known to me, and it's sort of like a message from the universe. I have to see it, and now I'm missing it tomorrow, but I will be at like I said at Montclair, unless I can. I might ask Mike to send a link or something. I don't know. But I know him because I decided two summers ago to try to podcast, in other words, do what I'm doing here on a film set, on this independent film that was shooting in Connecticut, actually, a couple of summers ago that he was producing. And the editor, rather, is a friend of mine, and he was kind of assembling.
Oh, Michael Taylor?
Oh, yeah. He's a good friend. So you know Michael, who I just spent several evenings this last week hanging out with, because I was also hosting a screening series in the city, and I showed a film that he edited, and the director was there too. And then the next night, he took me to see Taxi Driver. You remember that 40th anniversary? I don't know if you heard about this. They were part of Tribeca. They showed Taxi Driver 40th anniversary reunion and screening and all. And so I wasn't going to go, but he had a ticket. I'm going to say no to Michael Taylor. It's not a good idea. But he was on the set, and I met the filmmaker at that time. And I interviewed a bunch of people, and one of the people I interviewed for the podcast was Mike Ryan. And I knew who Mike was, and I was looking forward to eventually bringing him on anyway, so it was a perfect excuse. And so, you know, now that I think about it, he did tell me he was going to Memphis to do this movie. I bet the name of your podcast, no, well.
It was before.
It was before, oh, right, no, it was 2014, the summer of 2014.
It must have been after then.
Yeah, he was telling me about this film. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if I listened back that he mentioned Free Indeed by title on that podcast. Let's go to the videotape. And we're back. Well, all right, so I got to see it. But you shot in Memphis in 2014, right?
Yeah. Okay. And then it took me about a year and a half to edit it after that.
And then did it have its world premiere at South by Southwest?
Venice. It won best prize, best film for in the Orzani section.
Oh yeah. Now that you're mentioning it, I did see that on your trailer on the Vimeo trailer site. I think it said something about that. You gotta put that together.
So it's
having a great. It's connecting. I mean, the film festivals seem to go for it.
Some festivals. You know, I'm a determinist in the sense that the people who see it are the ones that should see it. I don't, you know, there's not a lot, you don't have a lot of control over
it. Put it out in the universe and let people discover it, right? The right people will.
Or not,
So you're not big on promoting? Like getting your, whoring yourself out?
No, not really. I don't understand how it works, really.
Yeah.
I mean, I figure it takes everything I've got to make it. And,
You had to hire a publicist, though. Maybe not. Mike took care of all that?
Mike's handling all
that. That's the advantage of having a good producer is he knows, and he kind of can cut through a lot, and he can see, he has sort of a clear vision, I guess is my point. That's why I liked talking to him too. You know, he opened my eyes to a few things, and I'd love to get him back on. You know, so I'm waiting because the next part, I was going to try to find the follow the life cycle of that film I was telling you about in Connecticut, where Mike was there and Michael Taylor. And the idea was then to talk about, we did, because they finally got that film into Toronto. Mm-hmm. They couldn't get it into some of the other films. Anyway, and then the idea next would be the distribution. Mm-hmm. Talk to them about distribution and then ultimately theatrical kind of the life cycle thing. And so that was the idea behind it. But it's already 2 years. Most films move a little faster.
Yeah.
But that,
well, I mean,
whatever.
I see films that premiere at a festival and then 2 years later come out for some sort of small theatrical distribution.
Right.
I don't know. I don't know how it works.
No. Nobody really does. Mm. I mean, you can put together, I guess, your ace team and everything, and put the formula together. Especially the more money you have, it's easier to hire everybody you need to. And it just still doesn't mean the film's gonna connect. But you're right. There's no real secret recipe that's gonna guarantee. I don't know whatever it is you're looking for. You know.
No, I mean, but I'm looking to finish the film.
Yeah.
I mean, that's...
And to move on to the next, necessarily? Do you feel like this passion to keep it going, the train on the tracks, or it's just a matter of the film at the time that you're working on and getting it finished? And
yeah, I mean, it takes all of my energy and intelligence to make a film that's authentic to its subject, to whatever it is about, and make that film as a self-sufficient entity or experience or object that is representing its world authentically. Whether people want to participate in that or not is completely out of my control. You know what I mean? And no matter how much I promote it or how much I tweet about it, it doesn't make people any more or less interested, I don't think, if it's not going to resonate with them. You know, and I know that the films, I think there are plenty of people who would appreciate the film. But I just don't have the facilities to make that happen. Do you know what I mean? So I feel like making the film as good as it can be for what it is what I enjoy.
Right.
You know, as far as answering the question of what am I doing? Yeah, I mean, of course you want to have I'm a full-time professor, so I have a job. It's a good job. I mean, I would like to be making films more often. And I would like to, that's what I'm doing now. It's just now that I have resources and stability to do that. You know, I've already shot another one. I'm editing that now, and I've got like five different screenplays, and I've got other treatments, things I'm developing, working on all the time that I'd love to get made. So it's just how much time there is in the day.
Yeah, no, gotcha. If you make a film and put your heart into it and all your minimize distraction and see it through to its most authentic entity or self or whatever, and you put it out there, hopefully then the festival programmers, which is an essential part of the whole life cycle, to at least initially, especially, and then press and then all these things, they seem to be necessary. But if it's a great film and real, people will like it and connect with it, and then it will I think, you know, it'll find a home in a way among.
Maybe I don't know.
I mean, it seems.
I don't believe in meritocracy. I don't think that necessarily programmers are. I mean, they've got their own
agendas.
They've got things they have to deal with. Obviously, it's not just picking the very best film all the time. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Every festival's different. They have to consider their audience. So, I guess what I'm saying is I don't rate the quality of a film on its audience. You know what I mean?
On watching it and responding to it, I think sometimes I don't know. I have this one. Maybe I'm on some level naive. I don't know, but I kind of still feel like other than maybe one or two festivals that can actually put agenda before quality, if they want to, or they're playing with that tenuous, you know, thing where they're going to put some big premieres and all that because they want that glamour. You know what I mean? Because I think most other festivals that don't really play in that world, that they're putting the best possible films they can get. Otherwise, they're not going to be around because people are not going to go to those. If they're going to be a lot of bad films or flawed films, they're, you know, people aren't just going to attend. So I think it's up to everybody to try to work with the best possible stories, you know.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I'm trying to figure out how to phrase it, but everyone has a different idea of what the best film is. So obviously no one is consciously trying to program crap movies. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that different people, different programmers, individuals at festivals have different ideas of what a good film is.
Understood.
And how it appeals to their audience, their market that they're trying to.
Sure.
So, and this film would or would not fit that. And that's not a measure of quality.
Understood. Right.
It's a measure of who their audience is and who those individual people are.
Right.
And whether they get it or not.
Yeah. Well, you know, this being on here is like guarantees you right to the longevity as a filmmaker. Okay, so the film is called Free Indeed, produced by Mike Ryan, we've established, and directed by Jake Mahaffey, New Zealand's own. you said South By, and then you were at...
what does it play in Nashville? It won three awards.
Oh, it was at Nashville?
It just won three awards at Nashville,
I was there last year, actually.
Okay.
It's a Tennessee film, so they probably like that.
Yeah, I'm sure. I wasn't there, unfortunately, but...
You agree here?
Nashville, what else? It's played a few others recently.
Right. And then it's going to be, though, coming right up at the Independent Film Festival, Boston.
It's going to be Boston.
And then in Montclair.
Yeah.
And then you'll be here through those, and then you're back in...
I'll be there for Boston, one of the Boston screenings and one of the Montclair screenings, and I go back. And then I don't really remember where it shows after that.
Yeah. Well, I'll try to attend one of those you're at.
Yeah,
that'd be nice to see you again.
Mike will be there.
Okay. Well, for sure Montclair, I would assume.
He's going to be in Boston as well.
Oh, that's great. Oh, so maybe I'll run into him. That's good. I'll have to go to the Free Indeed. That's actually, I believe, Saturday night.
7:45.
Okay. If you're in New England, for God's sake, you can get to Boston this weekend. I'm going to post this in time so people can have the option.
Somerville Theater, 7:45 on the 30th.
Thank you. Well done. And then in Montclair, the weekend of May 6th, 7th, 8th, that weekend, the final weekend of the Montclair Film Festival.
It plays on the 7th and the 8th, somewhere.
Two screenings, right.
Montclair.
Well, we'll get that information onto the show description so people know how to find it in the Northeast here. Between Montclair and Boston, if you're listening, you can definitely make that one of those three screenings. And, hey, Liz, it was great to meet you. And this is a nice little surprise.
Thank you.
For you and me. Both of us. Thanks. Can't wait to see you. Free Indeed. And thank you for that. And last up here, we are getting into a conversation with the final conversation, I might add, that I actually just had this morning. Last night I watched Imperial Dreams. It stars John Boyega, who this was shot after Attack the Block, but before Star Wars. and they postponed the theatrical of Imperial Dreams till after Star Wars, which is you know, the time is now, but the film will be coming out in the next few months, and we'll stay on top of that. But it's a terrific film. Again, it's called Imperial Dreams, and I really enjoyed it, and I really enjoyed my conversation with the filmmaker, Malik Vital, which we're going to listen to right now. This is a great conversation. Thank you very much. Here's my conversation with Malik. Thank you.
Really?
When did you text me back? Because I must have passed out at some point.
I keep my phone on that little moon thing, do not disturb.
Yeah,
so
me too.
I never look at it, so
yeah.
I think right before I went to sleep, it was like at 1 or something.
Oh, okay. I must have been out by then. Even my son, who's here with me, he's only 12, but he stays up later than me now. But I think I was editing one of the segments from yesterday with Laura, I think, and so I must have just at some point or other started falling asleep and not realizing it. And then woke up like at 4 in the morning because the lights were on, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And saw your text.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, now, I don't want to, God forbid that you don't have it on the moon thing and it does wake you, but I figured he's sleeping. He's not going to wake up if I text him back. So I thought, let me text him so at least I won't forget.
Was your son still awake at 4?
No. Fortunately, no. But he... You know, he saw me, and he's like, I saw him come in, and then I fell right back to sleep, but he's like, left all the lights on. He just, come on, you know.
Is he in school?
What do you think? The lights turn out by automatic?
Yeah.
Well, he's on vacation this week. So,
It's so great for him to be here.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the main reasons I came up, is because it just coincided with his vacation. I think I probably might have come up regardless, but I would have. But
yeah.
But since he was on vacation, I was like, this is even better because now I can bring him up to Vermont and then we're going to go to Boston for a few days.
It's fantastic, especially he's like, you know, he's soaking it all in even though he's acting like he's playing video games.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, he's sleeping right now.
It happens. That's what happens. You know, I did that as a kid.
True.
That, you know, I was doing different things, but
I
was still soaking it in.
Yeah, and then it influences you. It impresses you. And then as you become, you know, a person, you're like, oh, I went to this thing. I went to that thing. I went to that festival with my dad. And, you know, not that I drag him around too much, that much, but, you know, it's more for me right now. It's like I want him to enjoy it.
Yeah.
But he made like this short film for school.
Yeah.
And he was really got into it, and he was very excited, and they had a little film festival in the evening, and they showed all the shorts that the students made, and he was so excited. I mean, there was a turn in almost his personality that day.
Yeah.
Because he never wanted to, he doesn't like attention, historically. Yeah. So I said, do you want to come on, just do a quick podcast with me? Because, you know, like a joke, and he said, yeah, and he did, and it was very cute as we came off for a while. That's all it takes. You just have to make a little short, and you can be
amazing.
On my podcast. It doesn't require, you know, years of academic study and all.
Yeah. So he's quitting school.
Yeah. Anyway, I was really like, I didn't go to the, this is my third night, was last night, actually, here at Vermont, College of Fine Arts. And I didn't go to the first two nights because I had my kid with me and because I had seen the two films. Mm-hmm. But I hadn't seen Imperial Dreams, which is your first feature, right?
Yes.
And so I was looking forward to it. But I didn't, you know, I had no expectations. And I mean, I figured it was going to be good because they're showing it here. But I was really moved.
Thanks, man.
Yeah. It was really.
I mean, we wanted to, it's nice when people can go watch and they don't really know what to expect. But we wanted to make an experience where, you know, just anyone could just go and spend a day out in Watts and kind of get an understanding of what that culture is and what are some of the challenges out there and give it to them in, you know, a wholesome way that, you know, feels like a little family movie, but it's also has a lot of the conventions of a lot of the films, the gangster films that we love, but like a gangster film.
Oh, that's true. Right. I guess you could say those two worlds converge or, you know, intersect for that during this day. Yeah. Well, we're talking with Malik Vital, right?
That's Malik Vital, yeah.
Vital. And the film is called Imperial Dreams, and it I guess it was you made it in 2014, I think, right? Or it came out in 2014, right? Did it tell me a little bit about?
Yeah, it premiered at Sundance in 2014, and
that's the one in Utah.
It's somewhere cold. I always get those places mixed up. I think it might be Utah.
Yeah, I think it's Utah.
And we started the journey maybe at like 3 years or 4 years before time, and I'd met a young man in the projects out in Watts, which is South Central Los Angeles. His name is Bobby Yeye Jones. And he told me his story about recently getting out of jail for, he was at the time he was 21, and recently getting out of jail for 6 years. And while he was in jail, he had like a transformation, wanted to get away from gang life and started reading books and whatnot and wanted to become a writer and an actor. So when we talked, he was like, look, I want to get out of this. Let me be in the movie, please. And I put him in one of the short films I was making, and then shortly after we started hanging out more, and then you know, I was like, I think this is a great jumping off point for a character and a feature, you know, someone that wants to change from this old life into something new. And that's where we started fictionalizing it. And I wrote it with one of my best friends. His name is Ismet Prisic. He's a novelist, lives up in Portland, but he's originally from Bosnia. And he has a similar kind of war-torn sensibilities as a lot of these young gang members have.
Yep.
So he was able to kind of infuse that into the narrative. And we wrote it together over the course of a couple years. And we're lucky to get support from the Sundance Institute Screenwriters Lab and a lot of different advisors there. And then we went through another lab in Jerusalem in 2012, the Jerusalem International Film Lab, where they brought us out there three times. To work with a story editor, Claire Downs, this amazing British story editor. And then we hooked up with the production company Super Crispy. And we had three amazing producers, Catherine Fairfax Wright, Andrea Sperling, and Jonathan Swartz, and, you know, continued to, like, mold the script for the screen. And then went and shot in the fall of 2013 and, you know, put together this team to make it. And, you know, we're just really... the film was graced by having John Boyega as a lead because, you know, he anchors the whole thing, and, you know, his biggest gift, I believe, is his ability to be a storyteller. So, you know, he really understood the story and carries that out throughout the whole film.
This is right. He's British.
Yes.
You know, you forget immediately that, that's the case. I mean, he really, this is the first time I've really been able to really tell, like, that what a fine actor this kid is, you know?
Yeah. And yeah, then, it's his film. It's his film, definitely.
You know? Well, he's in every person, pretty much in every film. Frame, just about.
Yeah, he's in every bit of it. And, you know, from my perspective, it's nice because I can go and watch it over and over and over again.
Yeah, did you watch it last night?
I watch the last 20 minutes every time it screens because it's all the last 20 minutes has a very alive feel to me that it just it always works.
You're particularly pleased with that. You don't see the flaws as much in those scenes, or is it that
you always
see them. You just know it works.
You always see them. I think you just see the love, you know, of what a group can do together.
Yeah,
and I think that last 20 minutes is a great example of a group of storytellers coming together to figure out something that we never had. We didn't have enough understanding of it before we started, but we had a direction of how we wanted to get there, and we found a way as a group to do that. And that's special about it.
Yeah, you also got another great actor in there. I mean, there seems to be a bunch because everybody's very, very good in this, which is, in part, a definite sign of a good director and a team, as you're putting it. You have Glenn Plummer in there, who's for 3 decades been on television and movies like all the time. I mean, but again, a very could have been a very, I guess,
surface cliche.
Right. The tropes, that stuff. But it really avoided that. And there's a scene. This is after a fairly intense interaction between the two characters. John, but
it's okay. You just spell out the scene if you want to get spoilers.
Okay. it's been out for a while, I suppose. But we want people.
Hasn't been out.
Can we? Oh, it has not come out.
It releases
out
this fall. So the thing
it does. See, that's story. The question. I don't remember coming out. I didn't want to sound either ignorant, but coincidentally, I did. but there is editing, which I won't do. But but I was thinking timeline-wise, it must have come out, but how did I miss it? Because, and you're so lucky, because in a way, I guess it made sense. I'm going to guess, and tell me if I'm wrong, does Star Wars have anything to do with the title?
It has a big thing to do with it.
Okay.
So it was like, we were going to, you know, sell it, and then John got Star Wars. And
I heard about that.
Everyone's like, all right, let's pull it back and sell it afterwards.
Such sense.
It does, yeah.
I mean, what a gift. You want the film, of course, to stand on its own merit, and there's plenty of merit for it to stand on, but a lot of people are going to see the film that may not have. And you may get other demographics, you may get, I don't know. It's just what a great... People, of course, knew him from Attack the Block, but he's been... done a lot since, but this is great. So what was the plan for the when is it now planned? You said it
in the fall.
In this fall of 2016.
And if people want to keep track of when it comes out, they can go to our Facebook page. It's Imperial Dreams the movie. Mm-hmm. And then just add on there, and then we'll have screenings, and it's supposed to be a limited release, so mm-hmm. then they'll know if they'll have screenings in their particular town or somewhere close by, and then shortly after it'll be available on other platforms.
Yeah. Well, there's an element of, to me, that of unpredictability. Like, nobody knows how this film will do. So there, it almost has, sounds like you guys are conservatively planning the release. Yeah. Might be bigger. You know, it generally, if it hits, then other cities will do it, or it'll have extended.
Yeah.
And all those wonderful things might happen. I was getting to, before I went off onto the tangent, I was saying that there's a rather intense scene in a car with Glenn Plummer, who plays John Boyega's character again. What is his name in that?
Maybe we'll paint it as there's a challenging situation that Glenn Plummer is in as well.
Yes.
And, you know, the thing with Glenn, he... That's our casting director, and she, you know, she mm-hmm. pulled a couple people, and she was like, you know, what about Glenn? And I was like, interesting, mm-hmm. very interesting, and read him a couple times, and got a chance to meet him, and saw his range, and he was very giving with that range, mm-hmm. you know, which, you know, is a testament to him just loving, you know, performing. You
sure.
know, we would run scenes, and I'd ask him to do all. The whole spectrum, because for some scenes I wasn't too sure, mm-hmm. and I needed to like push buttons in him to, you know, get reactions from Boyega's character, whose name is Bambi. He was a catalyst for Bambi often within the story. And, you know, talking back about, you know, possible tropes that we could have hit with his character, I think my first note to Glenn was after we cast him, it was, you know, everything you're doing is motivated by love. You care, you really care about him, and you want the best for him. You see what could really, you see the gift, mm-hmm. and his gift of wanting to be a novelist, and you want to support him as much as possible. Now, he comes from a different culture, so that support's going to come in a different way. But that's one of the reasons why it's like every time we see him, we're like, oh, I get it. You know, and for us, that was important to kind of communicate that on screen.
It seems like everybody had to grapple with, at some point or other, this decision about living in a particular economy of a financial economy, but also you described it as people dealing, like living in a war-torn situation, and everybody is making choices that about survival, financially and otherwise, meaning Bambi has decided to, you know, go against the what's easiest. He's offered solutions, you know, which would keep him in that economy, as I'm describing it as an economy or as a community. But everyone else, they've also had that moment in time maybe more than once, where they've chosen to do what they felt they had to do.
Yeah.
One scene was, of course, with his girlfriend, the mother of the little boy.
Yeah,
the,
played by Kiki Palmer.
Kiki Palmer?
Yeah, Kiki Palmer from Aquila and the Bee.
Oh, very good.
Yeah.
Wow, she's grown up, I guess.
Yeah.
It's like 10 years ago.
Yeah, she's not even recognizable. Yeah.
No. And the little boy.
Yeah.
What's his name?
His name, so they're twins.
Okay.
It's Justin and Ethan Coach.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, they're very good. They're convincing as one single person.
They are one single person.
They are. Yeah, indeed. Yes. I mean, it's another case of child. It's an intense role, so I could see it helps on many levels to split it up, you know.
Yeah.
John Boyega's character Bambi has gotten out, and that sort of launches the story of the film, which is him getting his young son back and trying to
do anything to take care of his son.
And get things on track and begin his life as a writer and as a thoughtful person. But they do go back to visit the mother.
Yeah.
Played by Kiki Palmer.
We're not going to describe where she is. We're going to try to keep a little thing.
Before you were like, spoilers are okay.
Was me being a little bit of a brat.
Okay. Okay. Well, I appreciate your guiding me now because it's tricky.
Yeah.
So anyway, they visit the mother and she just sort of, she talks about having to do what she had to do.
Yeah.
You know, she made choices based on also pretty much the same set of principles that Bambi makes choices. It's just,
I got to survive. This is what I'm doing.
Right. And he does the same thing.
If we help the audience understand the root of the survival technique, then it really helps them, root for that character. Although sometimes the root or sometimes that like survival tactic is something that is looked or frowned down upon in other cultures. You know, that was the main thing, is trying to help the audience understand a different psychology and perspective of this culture where people just carry guns, people sell drugs. It's because there's no
right.
It's a different economy.
Yeah. I mean, it's true. And you, as a storyteller, I'm wondering how much of your attention went into that old paradigm or paradox of how much do I need to change people's perspectives and how much am I just telling my story as honestly as I know how, and fuck what people think or what it might reinforce for more ignorant people or less thoughtful people.
Yeah, I think, in the beginning coming into the story, because I didn't grow up in the same situation, although my father, my real father grew up in the same situation, then my mother raised me in a totally different way.
Mm-hmm.
But having visited my father every few years when I was younger, I saw this different side of who I could have become. Maybe later in life, that's maybe why I connected with Bobby, So once I got there,
Bobby Jones is the person that
the story's inspired by.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And when I got there originally, it was kind of like a contextual, like outside in view. And then after hanging out with everybody, I started to, I guess, respect their perspective. You're never going to really have someone else's perspective, but you understand that it is a different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you just went and lived out in South Central LA for, a half year, you'd be like, okay, there's no grocery store here. What do I do for food? Okay, I'm just going to McDonald's, just going to this liquor store. I don't have a job. What do I do for money? Okay, I'm going to do this, this, and this. This person doesn't like me. They happen to have a gun and want to shoot me. I'm going to carry a gun because that's my only form of protection. So you start to slowly understand how you need to survive in that world.
Mm-hmm.
These people outside of this, 8 blocks perimeter are also not happy, and they may want to start something with me. So then I can't take public transportation to get out of my space. So you start to really understand a different psychology of life. And then you realize you have to respect that on the screen, and you hope that you're able to infuse that in the characters' journeys, and really drive the priorities of the characters' journeys based off of that psychology. So,
and this is these are the kinds of conversations I assume you were having with your team from this what was the British woman who
Claire Downs.
Claire Downs, excuse me.
Yeah, so it was great.
And with Super Crispy Folks and all that. These are the kinds of story points that you must be like figuring out.
Yeah, and then, oftentimes that was something that you'd have to share with everybody approach-wise. This is what we're doing. But then, at a certain point, they would bring the notes from their perspective that weren't in the culture. And then, you'd have to share with them, hey, let's think about it from the culture out instead of our culture in.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense.
It does, yeah.
Yeah.
The last actor I want to just mention, because, again, a small performance, but very memorable, is the mother, I thought was really...
Bambi's mother.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And the brother. There's, I guess I could say everybody. I just...
We ended up having such a wonderful, dynamic ensemble cast, and a lot of people don't have a lot of time on screen, but people are maximizing their roles, and what they're doing is a lot of times is they're doing so much in such a short amount of time, and they're communicating so much with gestures other than verbal.
That's true. Yeah.
It's quite powerful, yeah.
Yeah, less is more in this, for sure. It's a cliche, but John Boyega, like we said earlier on, is in just about every scene, but somehow or other, it doesn't feel like you're still learning right to the end, getting more and more texture, more and more of his character, and more nuance from his.
Yeah, and it's I would just call it a gift. It's something almost like. Sidney Poitier-ish. Once you kind of round out the film, you just go like,
yeah,
it's a marvel that you look at him and he's got this ability to allow the audience to find themselves in him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that might be his greatest gift, is his ability to open up and let someone into him, because then you're able to transport yourself into the story and go on this journey through him.
Right, sure.
And he doesn't shake you out of him,
Yeah.
He's very giving in that way.
Right. Well, people will be able to check out the film. But we'll keep people, of course, abreast of the... maybe.
Yeah. Do you guys have, a little descriptions place where you can put a link to Imperial Dreams, the movie?
Yeah, yeah. By the way, yes. Oh, yeah, yeah. And then as the fall approaches, I'll do another round of...
Okay.
With getting the word out, helping to get the word out. And I'm sure our paths may even cross again.
Great.
There might be another opportunity as the release cuts forward. I usually get invited to.
Yeah. I'm excited for your son to see the film.
Well, I was going to say, it's funny. I did want to take him.
Yeah.
And I didn't push too hard because I kind of feel like, to some degree, I'm dragging him around.
Yeah.
But afterwards, when I realized, he would probably enjoy seeing, because he did love Star Wars, So I'm assuming he would have really enjoyed seeing one of the actors, do something different. And as a dad of a relatively young son, and I'm a single parent too, and I look at it and it was, I definitely relate on some emotional level to that strong, visceral need to take care of and protect. And the feelings around not doing, being adequate enough, is really strong. And just, but their scenes and the love was so very, very visceral, very, very present.
Yeah.
I really felt something there.
Although there is action and, some violence and swearing and, all the normal stuff a gangster film has, the central story is that father-son story.
Yeah.
And, because it is a 5-year-old boy, we have to make sure that we're not getting too dark. It has to be able to kind of hold that tension, but also, you want to bring in that different audience. So there is excitement and the tension and all the things that make a film kind of sexy and entertaining, but we're trying to hit both notes.
Yes,
so I think it'll be great to share with a lot of younger people and get their perspective on it.
Oh, you'll probably have plenty of opportunities for that. I'm going to guess coming up. You live where? By the way,
I live in Los Angeles.
You're in Los Angeles?
Yeah,
grew up out there. All this was shot in and around Watts, or is it?
All shot in and around Watts.
What was that experience? I mean, the community?
Because I'd hung out with Bobby a few years before we shot, the community was ultra supportive.
They were.
Almost more supportive than if you were shooting on backlot at Universal and giving them $100,000 a day.
Mm-hmm.
it was just like a deep love that they had for what we were doing. And, you know, they had a chance to meet me over a couple of years, and they, you know, there was a certain point where the housing authority wanted to take the location of the projects away from us, mm-hmm. which is, you know, pretty much the whole movie. And they stood up on our behalf and petitioned and said, no, this is positive. We need this. We need this story out there. Mm-hmm. And while we were shooting, you know, there was people on our crew that were from the community in mm-hmm. front of and behind the camera. So it was definitely like, you know, it's a piece of their community, although it is from, you know, our perspective. It's definitely, you know, mm-hmm. a group effort. So it couldn't have been better. It really couldn't have been better. And, you know, we ended up getting the location back. And the day before we went to shoot at that location, a young man got shot and killed, lost his life. And it's, you know, it was another, like, question of, should we make this film there? And again, they stepped up and they said, no, this is, mm-hmm. we need this story out there. Mm-hmm. So please come. And, you know, by the time we went and shot there, it was, usually when someone gets shot in the projects for the next few weeks because of potential, you know, follow-up or retaliation, everyone stays indoors, mm-hmm. which was very similar to our story. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you see a lot of police presence. And, you know, it's just, you know, we had to represent that on screen. We have to, mm-hmm. you know, we have to show, you know, the ups and downs, the duality of living there, you know, within the characters and within the actual, you know, culture of violence there too. So, you know, we had to show a little bit of everything, but they respected that. But, you know, they see that our intentions were pure, so they couldn't have been any more supportive.
And the title references?
The title reference, so it's called the Imperial Courts Housing Projects.
I gotcha.
Okay. So, you know, it's kind of a riff on the American Dream. Bambi's mm-hmm. access to the American Dream. Mm-hmm. But that's also like the title of the book that he's writing. And it's got, you know, some other deeper meaning once you actually get in and see the film. I won't, you know, go too deep into it.
Right. We'll let people tease it out on their own there.
Exactly.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
This is great.
Yeah, no, I had a great time. Glad I got to see it and glad I got to meet you and hang out with you.
Brad.
All right.
I can't wait to see, like, you know, 10 years from now, your son's, like, teaching at Vermont College of Fine Arts.
Well, he's making stop animations now. I figured if he's going to be on the phone, do something creative rather than just play whatever video game. Well, so,
video games are creative because, you know, you never know. He may end up designing them.
Yeah, true. But, you know, I think to use the creative side, too, is good. He's creative, but he needs to – he's loving the stop animation stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's really into it. So,
that's awesome.
Yeah. Thanks, man.
Yeah, thank you.
I got to tell you, I'm driving south on I-89. There are remnants of snow. Did I mention that it snowed the other day? It snowed for hours and hours. It was just depressing as hell. You know, you leave New York, it's 60 degrees, 65 degrees, sunny, and then you come to Vermont, and it's like, starts snowing. And it's barely cracking 50 degrees up in this place. You know, I mean, all the snow up at the campus was gone by the time we left. But I'm driving down the highway. I still see lots of snow, remnants of snow on the floor, on the grounds, in the woods. Anyway, we'll be leaving this area very shortly. Where it's sort of sad on another level because I really love Vermont. It's a big part of my youth. Story goes, very briefly, that I grew up going to summer camp every summer. And people who listen to the show know about that. Every summer I went to summer camp. But when I was going to summer camp as a camper, it was in Wallkill, New York, which is right outside New Paltz, just you know, barely 2 hours from New York, and I grew up going there. But when I became a young adult and I became of age to be a camp counselor in my late teens, college age, half the camp went up to Vermont. There was a split, a bifurcation. Part of the camp stayed in Wallkill. Eventually, that segment moved to another town nearby, Pine Bush, New York. But then there was this other part of the population that went to Vermont, and I was part of that group. And basically, I was it because the guy who took everybody up there, the camp director, Greg, he reached out to me. So nobody else reached out to me not to go to Vermont. Nobody reached out to me to stay in New York. I may have stayed if somebody had reached, but they kind of pursued bringing me up as staff. So I went up there. I was up there in Vermont, which the Thetford Fairley area, which is close to the Connecticut River, which divides Vermont from New Hampshire. And I was up there for many summers, all through my 20s, basically. Other than a couple of exceptions, I would go there till 1990. So there were some exceptions, but a lot of the summers in the 80s, I was up in Vermont and had a beautiful time every summer. And then that ended. I got older, and I stopped going, and the camp ultimately ended up closing some years later, and I didn't go to Vermont anymore. But this summer, the year after the camp closed, there was a reunion at the actual location, the original location up in Vermont, and I went to that, and it was just like stepping back in time. And it's difficult because as I'm recording this and going down the highway, I'm probably within an hour of that place. But and I've got my kid with me. I want to take him there, but I think it's going to have to wait to the next visit. But I'm looking around, and there's pine trees, and there's mountains all around, snow-capped, and it is really wonderful to be back in this beautiful state. Yeah. So, I don't know. Do you have that kind of nostalgic connection with a part of the country? Or maybe with a part of another country? I have that with upstate New York, and I have it with Vermont. Well, I had a great time at the Vermont College of Fine Arts MFA in Film Program residency. Thank you to everybody for making me feel and making me and my son feel so at home and so comfortable. And my kid was just saying to me before, as we were leaving, when can we come back? So that's a great sign. The family that kind of hosted us and put us up were terrific. They treated my kid like one of their own. I ran out to see Imperial Dreams last night at the Savoy Theater in downtown Montpelier. And they invited Jacob Ober for dinner, and it was nice. I didn't have to drag him to the movies or leave him abandoned by himself all night in the house. So I want to thank you to Jay Erickson and all my friends at the Vermont College of Fine Arts. Hopefully we'll be back subsequently. I look forward to that happening. Thank you very much for being such a great sponsor to and supporter of the podcast. And thank you to everybody who appeared on this episode of the podcast as well. This is the end of the show. Thank you for listening. We'll be back in a few days with a brand new episode. I hope to have some new segments from Montclair Film Festival, which is coming up. I don't know that I'll have much time to do very much at Boston, but we'll see. You never know what happens, what's going to happen. I'll be in Boston through most of this coming weekend. We'll see if I can get much done there or snoop around and just check out the festival for part of a day. Who knows? Thank you very much. My name is Adam Shartoff. The name of the show, Film Wax Radio. This is episode 348. Until next time, take care.